Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the seventh program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is about the constitutional crisis. Will we still have free and fair elections 2026, 2028? We'll talk about the effects of federal action on election security, voter access, and confidence in elections, staff changes at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, commonly known as CISA, and the Department of Justice, DOJ, may undermine effective election protections. Voter suppression laws and regulations federally and at the state level may restrict participation. We're a little concerned. This show was pre-recorded on July 15th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. We're pretty excited. Jenna Bello is Maine's Secretary of State. She serves on the Executive Board of the National Association of Secretaries of State. She also serves on the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Welcome, Jenna.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Joyce Vance is a distinguished professor of the practice of law at the University of Alabama School of Law. She served as the U.S. Attorney for the Northern Division of Alabama from 2009 to 2017. She co-hosts two popular podcasts, Sisters in Law and Cafes Insider. She also publishes a daily newsletter, Civil Discourse with Joyce Vance. That's a must read for some of us on Substack. Welcome, Joyce. So glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's get started. Joyce, put it to you first. What's at stake and what's your number one concern?
Well, I think you nailed it with the topic for this session, because it's whether or not we can hold free and fair elections at the midterms and then in the presidential year. We're Americans. Everything comes down to our ability to vote, to have those votes counted. And I think at every stage in the election process, starting with registration, moving on to staying registered, which is a problem in some states, I think less so in Maine, voting and then having your vote counted, the challenge for us as Americans will be to be very vigilant in this next election to protect our own right to vote. If we live in a state where that right is secure, to figure out what we can do to help people in other states, and to insist that this next election be free and fair.
When we say free and fair, we don't mean like no poll tax, like you don't have to pay money to vote. When we say free, what do we kind of mean?
When we say free, we're talking about elections that are held so that the voters' wishes decide the outcome of the election. And I think a Secretary of State understands this far better than I do, but the whole goal is to make it possible for every eligible citizen to register to vote, to have that vote counted. And so the concern is, and look, I come from the Deep South where there's a long-term history of this. The concern is that powerful people will put their thumb on the scale of justice to tip the election their way. And we understand that there are a lot of ways that that happens. Everything from dark money to rejecting ballots for frivolous reasons. And so this is a project that will take vigilance on our parts to make sure that this next election comes off.
We're going to talk more about the ways this can go wrong and what vigilance, but I want to turn the question to you, Jenna. What's your number one concern and what do you think is called for?
When I think about free and fair elections, I think about the deep responsibility that election administrators have to create an environment where every citizen has the right to register to vote, to participate by casting their ballot, and the confidence in knowing that their ballot will be counted. And I think for 250 years in America, we have improved in so many different ways that right to vote, right? Because in the very beginning, it was propertied white males. And over time, our ancestors have fought hard, including in the Civil War, for more equality, more justice, more participation. And so in 2024, you saw more Americans participate in the election than ever before in our history. And we saw, despite all of the rhetoric and despite the fears and the attacks on election administrators, despite the swatting, even here in Maine, I mean, there was so many attacks on election administrators and doubts cast about the elections. We still saw Americans turning out in very large numbers to register to vote. And then we saw those votes counted. And I think my concerns as we move forward is I would have hoped that record turnout, that the security of knowing that the results were accurate and fair would have allayed this tide that we're in of election denialism and subsequent attacks on election workers. But instead, it seems that the Trump administration is doubling down in casting aspersion on election administrators and casting doubt on the 20 and going back to the lies about the stolen election of 2020, and are casting doubt about the integrity of election administrators in 2024. And what I fear is that election administrators all across this country are exhausted, and it's difficult to recruit people to work as election professionals and to volunteer in our elections. And free and fair elections depend both on strong laws, on the constitutional principles, but also on good people coming together all across this country from all parties to actually run the elections. And so as Secretary of State of Maine, I worry a lot about recruitment and retention of the people to do the work. And by extension, voter participation, because when voters lose confidence, and a study came out just this month that indicated when voters don't have confidence in the election, they're less likely to vote. So in Maine, for example, in the 2024 election, we had almost 75% turnout of our citizen voting age population. That's great. But we could be higher if more people had confidence, full confidence in our elections.
Is undermining confidence in elections then a voter suppression strategy, Joyce?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Undermining confidence in elections is a great strategy because it makes you walk away from voting on your own, right? People who don't want you to vote don't have to go to the trouble of undoing your registration or finding a way for your ballot not to count. They just convince you to stay home on your own. And so I think, you know, again, I'll refer to having watched this happen in the South, where for years, as people complain about voter fraud, something that predates Donald Trump, the real problem was always voter suppression. There was never meaningful voting fraud. As a U.S. attorney in Birmingham, my office looked for it vigilantly and didn't find it for 8 years. But perhaps more significantly, my Bush predecessor looked for it for 8 years, never prosecuted a case, and my Trump successor looked for it for 4 years and never prosecuted a case. It's just not a problem. It's voter suppression that's always been the issue. I mean, we all know, right? People wouldn't try so hard to keep you from voting if they didn't understand how important your right to vote is. And so my view, and I hope the view we adopt as a country, is the more difficult they make it for us to vote, the more they try to convince us that elections don't matter or can't be trusted, the more Americans will rise up and insist on their right to vote.
Yeah. How many ways can this go wrong? Like, there's a lot of action at the federal level. And Joyce, you've written about cuts at the DOJ and at CISA. Who's filling that gap? And what gaps are opening up because of those losses? Go ahead, Joyce.
There are a lot of potential pitfalls on the horizon. I would maybe start, I'll resist the question a little bit and start with what could go right. My neighbor across the street was so upset by the election results in 2016, she asked me what she could do. And I said, why don't you volunteer to be a poll worker? And so that's what she did. Her reaction was to go out and become part of the process, which, as Shenna says, this is just Americans running our own voting apparatus and making it possible for our friends and neighbors to work. And so I think what could go right is Americans turning out in record numbers to work in the elections, to help people become educated, high information voters, to be poll observers, in essence, to be guarantors of the election. Because there are some problems. It's very clear to me that the Trump administration will try to weigh in ways that are just really disturbing. For instance, it's clear that the Justice Department will no longer be litigating on behalf of voters. And that's happening at a time where the Supreme Court has increasingly narrowed the ability of private groups to litigate. It used to be that under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, ACLU, the Legal Defense Fund, all sorts of pro-voting groups would go out and litigate in the courts when states and localities or others were trying to hamper people's right to vote. Increasingly, that jurisdiction is being limited so that only the Justice Department can do it. And when the Justice Department does not want to do it, it means that our alternative is to become activists, not litigators. So that will be a new feature of the landscape in this coming election. There are obviously cybersecurity concerns in every election, but you know, the fact of the matter is we have now successfully run a number of elections since 2016, and even Donald Trump's guy in 2020 characterized it as the safest, the best election that had been run. We know how to do it, but federal cuts to the resources that states and localities need to run these elections is another disturbing feature of the landscape. You know, when you ask what could go wrong, well, what could go wrong is that folks don't have the resources that they need. That's something we need to be aware of. If you're going to make one phone call to your senator or your representative, make it be over this and insist that funding stay in place to run elections.
Can I talk about that? What are you hearing from your other secretaries of state? And I mean, I know you've been active with CISA. What are you hearing on those fronts?
And Joyce is exactly right. The lack of resources for state and local election officials is a real concern that all of us share. And the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency used to have a number of experts that could work with us as secretaries of state and with our local election officials and to do trainings. We did cybersecurity summits here in Maine for our election clerks. We did physical security trainings, including de-escalation training. We did emergency planning convenings of our clerks. And the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency was a core partner for all of that. They did a tremendous amount of facilitation for us and brought their expert trainers into Maine to help. Additionally, we've seen huge cuts to that agency. All of the people that we worked with seem to be gone. And we furthermore worked closely with the Election Infrastructure Information Sharing and Analysis Center, a national election security working group. And I chaired that election working group in 2024. It's a bipartisan group of state, federal, local officials, and it's convened by the Center for Internet Security. And through that organization, there were free services for election officials to protect our elections, particularly in the area of cybersecurity. The Trump administration zeroed out all of the funding for that collaborative work. And that was at the very beginning of the year. That funding has not been restored by Congress in the recent budget that passed. And we don't see any alternatives coming forward. So that raises concerns for us, because in 2024, we want to do some of those same exercises, the emergency scenario planning that was crucial in helping us prepare for and counteract the swatting that happened on Election Day. We want to make sure that we're able to do cybersecurity training for our clerks to help them protect their networks from malicious attacks. And with fewer resources, we'll have to create partnerships with law enforcement, with emergency management at the state level. And we'll certainly do that, but it just makes our job that much harder. And I think secretaries across the country are sharing those concerns.
I don't think people have such a good idea of what a cyber threat actually looks like. And you probably don't want to write the recipe for this, but can you just give us a general idea of what kinds of things you worry about?
One of the things this National Security Working Group convened around the election was a situation room. So a virtual Situation Room, where election officials and cybersecurity officials across the country were sharing information about what they were seeing. And what we saw on election day is malicious actors trying to conduct denial of service attacks or try to compromise state and local networks in different ways using malicious domains. And so those malicious IP addresses were literally being recorded in the SIT room as those attacks were targeting certain networks and being intercepted. And that would allow us to blacklist those IP addresses here in Maine before attacks even started, so we could proactively protect the state network. Now, what would happen if the state's internet came down on election day? Well, we're pretty old-fashioned. We have paper ballots. We don't have e-poll books. So the election would continue to run, but it would be disruptive and it would create confusion and fear and panic and make our job that much more difficult if we couldn't use our email or our internet to share information. So when you talk about cybersecurity threats, it's bad actors. Sometimes it's foreign nation states trying to disrupt operations or potentially compromise data in some way. Now, election officials back up our data in a number of ways. It would be very difficult to truly interrupt the election operation itself, but the chaos and the fear that that would generate concerns could be very, very problematic and disruptive.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is, will we still have free and fair elections? Our guests this afternoon are Joyce Vance, Distinguished Professor of Practice of Law at the University of Alabama School of Law, and Shenna Bellows, Maine Secretary of State. This program was recorded on July 15th. No listener calls are being taken. So we were talking about federal action that is compromising resources or casting doubt on elections, and I just want to go through some of the other things that we're watching at the federal level. Joyce, talk about the SAVE Act, where that stands, and what impact that might have.
Yeah, so the SAVE Act is enormously problematic. I think the worst feature of it is a feature that overlaps with Donald Trump's executive order on voting, which has been challenged in the federal courts, but the outcome of that challenge and whether or not his EO will be able to go into effect is still unclear. And in essence, the Republican Party has decided you should have to prove that you're a citizen before you can register to vote. Now look, of course you have to be a citizen to vote, and this may not sound very alarming to people until you start to think about what do you have to be able to prove that you're a citizen. There aren't very many pieces of paper that'll do that. A passport will do that, but it'll also set you back $120 to $150, which puts it out of reach for a lot of voters. Certain of the new enhanced forms of driver's license in Alabama, we call it Star ID. I think y'all call it Real ID every place else. That'll do the job for sure. Passport card. In some places, there are other kinds of ID that will suffice, but I think we're about to see that narrow. Maybe you have to have a certified birth certificate. Maybe just the paper won't suffice. Maybe this gets tangled up in the birthright citizenship question down the road. And so what we're seeing is classic voter suppression, an effort to make it more difficult for eligible citizens to vote. And that's really the opposite of what we want to see in these settings. What we really want to see is people making it easier for Americans to vote. The fact that these folks are focused not on making the elections more secure, not on doing the work that Shenna's talking about. You know, why would you want to cut these sorts of cyber preparedness events unless you're hoping that an attack will succeed? I find it very hard to give this a benign or a neutral reading. When you're putting your thumb on the scale to make it hard for people to vote, and specifically, by the way, for women who've gotten married and changed their names, it may be that that becomes increasingly difficult for us to register. Under the SAVE Act, you've got to show this ID to register, but also every time you re-register or update your re-registration. So if you move house, anything like this, it's not a one and done sort of issue and you're registered for life. This is going to be an ongoing problem that will impede people's ability to register.
How does it work in Maine, Shanna? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about that because in Maine, I run the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, right? And we had this deadline this year for Real ID. And right now, only about 30% of Mainers have the Real ID. And I just want to caution folks because members of Congress said, oh, well, if you show the Real ID, you're showing your citizenship. But Real ID is eligible for green card holders and other legal residents who are non-citizens. So Real ID is not actually proof of citizenship. Therefore, the only proof of citizenship is your passport or your birth certificate. Now, the federal government has required a certified birth certificate for Real ID. And then for married women, proof of that name change over time. So if the SAVE Act passes, the impact is going to be dramatic for married women and for rural voters who are more far removed, perhaps maybe don't have a passport, for older voters, for lower income voters. And I have real concerns about what we're going to see at the clerk's offices and at the polling places on election day, because we are seeing record-breaking traffic at the DMV branches. We are seeing really long lines and long wait times because of the demand for the Real ID and because of the nature of how long it takes to carefully review all those legally required documents, to review that proof of citizenship and process that. And so to take what we're seeing at the DMV and bring that into the voting place and the clerk's offices is very concerning. I think we would definitely see a dramatic reduction in who is able to participate in our elections. Your passport would be okay. Nobody else would.
Yeah. So where does that legislation stand right now? It passed the House, right? And it's over to the Senate. Is it going to come up for a vote pretty soon? What do we know about that?
You know, there has been some opposition to it, but this Senate has, you know, pretty much had the spine of I don't want to make an unfavorable comparison. They've been supine. They have not shown any backbone where Donald Trump is concerned. I think that there's a risk that it will pass. Will a handful of Republicans who aren't up for re-election band together and vote with Democrats? It's possible that people like Tom Tillis from North Carolina, who's not running, maybe Susan Collins will decide to cross over on this one. Hopefully she's listening to this and she'll decide that she should cross over and vote against the SAVE Act. But it's going to be a close call. And I think one of the issues that we need to be aware of is both the delays in the lines, which are concerning. I got my Real ID before the deadline, waited in line, you know, for maybe 15 minutes. One of my kids went in several weeks later and was there for hours. It's going to get worse as time goes on. So the message is, get your passport, get your Real ID now, do whatever you need to do as early as possible. You know, but passage of the SAVE Act is something, again, I'm starting to feel like a broken down record. It's only the second time I've said it today. When you make calls to your senators in Washington, they listen. And of course, you know, they tabulate them in the office, they track them. It's a myth that they don't listen to you. So start calling and maybe think about calling every day or once a week and ensuring that your senator knows that you do not want her to support the SAVE Act.
Okay. Now, Joyce, you've written about this as my last question about the federal level circumstance, but can Trump cancel the elections? Will he cancel the elections?
You know, we don't hold one national election in this country. We hold 50 state elections. There are perhaps extreme situations like invocation of certain acts around insurrection that would permit a president to do that. Let me tell you why I don't think it's going to be a problem here. When people who have autocratic inclinations, wannabe dictators, strongmen, come into power through elections, one of the most important things for their stability and their continued success in office is to sort of wrap themselves in the cloak of democracy, right? And the trappings of legitimacy. And so they hold elections. They just try to swing them in their favor, which is, I think, what we're talking about here. Viktor Orban in Hungary, who now oversees what he refers to as an illiberal democracy, it's a democracy in name only in some ways, continues to allow elections. Even Vladimir Putin has elections. And so there's this tug of war going on internally for them. Maybe they're worried about elections, but Trump is not going to be as worried about the midterms, where he personally is not at stake. We will see that election, I am quite confident. Again, the question is, will it be free and fair?
And how chaotic will it be? I mean, it seems, Shanna, like a lot of these moves are designed to, if not only allow, maybe even foster a chaotic environment.
I think that's right. I think the alarm and the chaos is sometimes the point. We see completely false, spurious allegations of voter fraud leveled at election officials all across the nation over and over and over again. We see these attacks on election officials and attacks on aspects of our elections, the voting machines that tabulate our votes on election day, which I liken to a modern day abacus, right? They're never connected to the internet. They can't be hacked externally by cyber criminals or foreign nation states. But we see questions about that and the push for hand counting all of the ballots, for example. These are the types of attacks we see on elections, which are just a little bit crazy making because they're absurd in terms of how you might actually implement some of the recommendations that come from the election deniers or the election enthusiasts. And so they seem designed, again, to sow chaos and fear and to make people give up, to make people feel apathetic. And I think especially given what Congress is doing so audaciously and so in some ways, it feels almost criminal in terms of the defunding of institutions that Americans really care about. And elections is just one area that isn't being funded right now. There are so many aspects of American democracy and American society that seem to be under attack that people can lose hope. But this goes back to what Joyce was saying. If we lose hope, if we give up, and if we let fear take over, then they win. And so I think it's really, really important that everyone continue to participate, continue to use your voice, continue to act. And I think we will have free and fair elections in 2026 and 2028, but only if we, the people, make it so.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you're saying if chaos and panic is the point, the antidote is to keep your head and stay focused and, you know, be disciplined as voters. Yeah. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's
I think that's exactly right. Keep calm and move forward, persist in pursuing our democracy.
All right. I don't want to get too Pollyannish here for a minute because I want to stick to the dark side for just a second more. What are we seeing at the state level? I read that, you know, Texas is considering one of its midterm redistricting in order to ensure Republican majority in Congress. What else is going on at the state level that we should watch? I mean, we've got a little something in Maine, but Joyce, give us a sort of a national overview of the states.
The concern is that we'll see states pass laws that will make it more difficult for people to vote. And the sorts of legal challenges that either, you know, myself as a former U.S. attorney would have brought or that some of the groups would have brought won't be available this go round. Look, I know you don't want us to be Pollyannas, and I'll be respectful of that, but the answer to all of this at the state level is a little bit Pollyannish. In Georgia, for instance, there's still some debate about whether it'll be effective, but the legislature passed a bill that says you can't hand a water bottle to people that are in line to vote. And, you know, if you're in Metro Atlanta in a traditionally Black polling place where they do whatever magic it is that they do to make those lines long, passing out water is actually a long-term strategy for getting people to vote. Well, if we can't do that anymore, it's going to fall upon voters to come prepared, to stay in line no matter what. And we've seen phenomenal work being done by student voters, actually, who create these text chains at universities saying, stay in line, and create the momentum to do that. Of course, because we have the 50 state elections, every state will do something a little bit different. And as you all know, you live in a state where you're extremely fortunate because your legislature is a little bit less predatory. In Alabama, for instance, there are aggressive measures being taken to discourage people who are naturalized American citizens from voting. They might be questioned, their ID might be questioned. Perhaps we've not seen this yet, but there is certainly some opportunity that we'll see ICE agents, at least from the distance mandated by federal law, have a presence there. And so again, we're seeing all of this subtle pressure that acts almost like a pincers movement designed to keep people from voting. It'll be more of a problem in red states, which is a little bit ironic when you think about it, and I think less likely to take place in significant ways in blue states. But again, this is something that we need to all do in our own state, be on top of what's happening. Your Secretary of State almost always will have a website. I know you do in Maine. We actually have one in Alabama because these folks are proud of the repressive measures that they're putting in place. Pay attention to what's going on. And when you see something objectionable, speak out. If you have the luxury of educating voters in other states because you're secure about what's happening in Maine, maybe find a place where close friends or family live and make sure that they're on top of the changes in their state too. We're going to see a rash of anti-voting legislation in the next probably next session of these legislatures, and that's what we need to be alert about.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Shenna Bellows, Maine's Secretary of State, and Joyce Vance, Distinguished Professor of the Practice of Law at the University of Alabama School of Law. Our topic today is the constitutional crisis. Will we still have free and fair elections? This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. Shenna, back to what's going on at the state level, outside. I mean, you could talk a little bit about what's going on in Maine, but then I, reflect on how that compares to what you're hearing from your colleagues in other states in terms of voter suppression and other anti-voting measures or voter protections, on the other hand.
So Mainers should be really proud of our tradition of free, fair, and secure elections and our wonderful tradition of high voter participation. Now, we fell down a little bit behind Minnesota. They were number one in the nation in voter participation, according to the survey that just came out from published by the Election Assistance Commission. Wisconsin slipped into number two, and we fell down to number three. So we were still third in the nation, but we lost our first place, and now we're number three. What we're seeing in Maine at the state legislative level, which is controlled by Democrats, and of course, under Governor Mills's leadership, there were no new attacks on elections that made it through the legislature, which was a huge relief. However, there is, of course, a ballot question, and I will read the question because I think it speaks for itself, but it would make a number of changes to Maine election law. And I think this is where the devil is in the details. So what makes Maine elections so strong? We have same-day voter registration. If you're not registered, you can register to vote on election day. We have a 30-day period where you can have no excuse absentee voting. You can go to your clerk's office, cast your ballot at a time that is convenient for you, and you can do that right up until close of business on the Thursday prior to election day. It's really easy to absentee vote in Maine. You can call your clerk and get your ballot mailed to you, or make that request online, or have a family member make that request on your behalf. And so the referendum question would change a lot of aspects of our elections. And I'll just read it. Do you want to change Maine election laws to eliminate 2 days of absentee voting, prohibit requests for absentee ballots by phone or family members, end ongoing absentee voter status for seniors and people with disabilities, ban prepaid postage on absentee ballot return envelopes, limit the number of drop boxes, require voters to show certain photo ID before voting, and make other changes to our elections? So that's on the ballot this November in 2025. Voters will decide, do they want to roll back some of our absentee ballot provisions to make it harder to vote by absentee? Do they want to limit those drop boxes? Do they want to have requirements around certain types of voter ID? And, you know, as an election administrator, as Secretary of State, I hope the answer is no, because I think that those laws are really foundational to our status and our ranking across the country.
Yeah, Joyce. What about the other kinds of election interference that might happen? AI manipulation campaigns, foreign meddling. There was a rumor I heard that some of the election machines were susceptible to Starlink interference. I mean, what about that kind of stuff? How much of that is for real?
I think there are a couple of different risks here. There's disinformation, which really plays into what Shanna's talking about, this notion of convincing people that elections aren't fair so that they won't vote. That's the thrust of disinformation campaigns. They are efforts to drive wedges in American voters on issues. We saw it in 2016, you know, with the whole notion of driving a racial wedge between voters and trying to convince them that they will lose if a certain candidate wins. We saw it again in 2020, again in 2024. And there are obviously malicious actors who believe that they benefit from using this disinformation either to discourage Americans from voting at all or to encourage them to vote for a certain candidate. I mean, I think we all understand what happened here, right? There were certain foreign interests, and something we always worry about. I used to worry at the Justice Department in national elections and increasingly in other elections too, is whether a malicious foreign actor or foreign group will try to target American voters with misinformation to encourage them to stay home or to vote for a certain candidate. Always a concern in every election. Again, there's an answer here, but it requires each of us to take responsibility for ourselves and for other voters, because the answer, as simple as it sounds, is the truth, the facts. Discerning voters who are willing to read information about complicated situations and draw their own conclusions about where they think the election will take the country. You know, if you're concerned, pick your interest about climate change. You need to be educated about the candidates. You need to make yourself, in essence, disinformation proof. That doesn't always work, especially for older people or other vulnerable people. On Facebook, for instance, which is just a cesspool of misinformation in this age, and other places where an algorithm can be used to target you. TikTok was notorious in 2024, for instance, for trying to persuade young Black men that Donald Trump would have their interests at heart if he was elected to office again. The answer is just common sense. It requires us to be smarter. This foreign component, let me just say, is always a concern. You know, Russia has been a longtime meddler in our elections. I know Donald Trump hates that, but the reality is Russia has certain interests. China has played a role. Something that's new is what we saw in Wisconsin with Elon Musk flooding the zone with money, trying to persuade voters to go a certain direction.
In the judicial election, you mean, right?
Right, the Supreme Yep. Court race in Wisconsin. And the great thing about the outcome of that election was it didn't work. Wisconsin voters were put off by that. But we're going to see enormous infusions of cash into the midterms. And it may be even worse by the time 2028 rolls around, because there's a case in front of the Supreme Court next term, which would give them the opportunity to just blow the roof off of limits on PACs working with campaigns and how that money could be directed. So increasingly, we're going to see these expensive elections where there's an effort to persuade or confuse voters, and the tonic for that will be voters fighting back.
Jenna, I know you've debunked some conspiracy theories about our election machines getting hacked. What do you think about the beliefs that Starlink satellites, for example, are zapping our scanning machines or here or in other states?
I think that conspiracies always flourish in times of uncertainty, and we're in a really awful time right now. It's really dangerous. We are in a constitutional crisis. Make no mistake, the administration is ignoring court orders, and we are seeing the complete elimination of due process for new Americans, people who are legally here, who've done nothing wrong, and including some citizens, particularly citizens of color. So in these times, which are so dangerous, it is an environment that people are susceptible to potential conspiracies. But I'm here to tell you, I have confidence that they're not going to steal the election by direct interference with the mechanics of the election itself. There are too many checks and balances on the process. And here in Maine, we have recounts. We have the ranked choice voting tabulation. And now we have post-election audits. And most states have a form of post-election audit. So I don't think that Starlink is going to interfere with the tabulators or could be used to interfere with the tabulators. And that's not just a belief that I have. I'm very active on Maine's Cybersecurity Advisory Council and at the national level with the Election and Cybersecurity Collaborative. And I've worked with Republican, Democratic, and nonpartisan staff and officials all across the country on election administration issues. And we may not agree on voter ID or some of the policies like same-day voter registration, but what I have found, by and large, that most election officials, if not everyone that I've worked with, is that people are really committed to the rule of law and committed to the integrity of our elections. So I may not agree with some of my Republican counterparts, particularly in the South, and I do think voter suppression is real. There are many politicians that would like to choose their voters rather than having their voters choose them. There's enough that we need to fight back against without looking for other dangers.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WRUFM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Shannon Bellows, Maine Secretary of State, and Joyce Vance, Distinguished Professor of the Practice of Law at the University of Alabama School of Law. This show is pre-recorded on July 15th. No listener calls are being taken right now. Joyce, I'd like to hear your opinion on whether the outcome of the elections 2026 and 2028 are going to be endlessly challenged in court, whether the lawyers are, you know, arming up to create post-election chaos.
Well, elections are always challenged after the fact. There are always some people who bring challenges, whether it's for particular races. Of course, that exploded in 2020 with Donald Trump's massive efforts to challenge the election. I think the takeaway, by the way, from 2020 is that the courts did their job. The courts stood up, and when it came to the moment, whether they were appointed by a Democratic president, a Republican president, or Donald Trump himself, federal judges stood for free and fair elections and ensured that the outcome was the just one and that the American voters' choice became president of the United States. The concern now is, will that hold up? And again, I am an optimist on this point for exactly the reasons that Shanna's talking about. Elections are verifiable. And despite what the conspiracy theorists would have you believe, when these challenges are brought in court, there are ballots that are counted, that can be recounted and audited. And when judges look at the outcome of these elections, there is an answer, one way or the other. By and large, we see judges rule the right way in these settings. By the right way, I mean in conformity with the outcome of the election itself. You know, the whole hanging Chad thing in 2000 in Florida, where the outcome of the presidential election turned on counting this very small minority of Florida ballots. I think that's a one-off sort of a situation. It was very unique. That won't be repeated. Could something like that be repeated? That's certainly a possibility. But when these cases go to court, the best lawyers will show up to defend election results on the behalf of American people. Judges will do their job. The biggest risk is, of course, delay, and that's difficult when newly elected politicians are transitioning into jobs or when people are trying to get prepared in advance of the time when they're sworn in. We will definitely have to navigate some of those difficulties. I don't think we should pretend that these elections will look the way we're used to seeing our elections look, with this very sort of a smooth process. There are certainly going to be a lot more bumps and wrinkles. But the great thing that we have behind our elections these next couple of go rounds is that people saw 2020, and an overwhelming number of Americans understood what was happening, and judges understood what was happening. And so these challenges will come to court with the burden of proving their legitimacy. There won't be any sort of presumption in favor of these sort of specious, ridiculous challenges that we saw in 2020. And maybe the last thing that I'll say about that is this: I was always fascinated by the fact that Donald Trump challenged the results of the election as to him, but all of the down ballot races were fine, right? Republican senators and members of Congress and other Republicans won. And somehow this miraculous form of election fraud occurred, where it was only the presidential race that was tampered with. Judges are very skeptical of those sorts of arguments that defy common sense. And even in Alabama, we've seen Republican-appointed federal judges sitting on the gerrymandering case in Alabama, where the legislature has allegedly engaged in a racial gerrymander. The Supreme Court agreed one time and ordered those districts to be redrawn, and the legislature has been recalcitrant. They even tried to avoid the Supreme Court's ruling. And the judges understand what's going on. They ruled the right way. I think we can count on them to do it again.
Oh, go ahead, Shanna.
I think this is so important because we're in an era of cruelty and fear, right? And we are seeing that cruelty and that fear manifest every single day with the actions of this administration and Donald Trump. If our reaction is to be equally cruel, to tap into anger and bring rage to the forefront, or to give up on our institutions, or to treat everyone with skepticism and hostility, then we're just going to see that cruelty and that fear-mongering work. We have to draw on the lessons of our history and the people like John Lewis, like Martin Luther King, who used tools of nonviolence, rhetoric of hope, and direct action, but nonviolent action, to insist on the right to vote and to move civil rights and voting rights forward. We need to draw on those lessons to tap into our better natures and to share hope and to strengthen the institutions. So, you know, I've talked a lot in the past about one of my early exchanges with our clerks, and one of the clerks saying, look, it used to be that people would come to the polls and they would bring pies and hugs. It was like homecoming day. And now elections are so stressful. I think the answer is to bring more pie to the polls, right? I think the answer, you know, I show up on election day, I tour the polling places, and I'm bringing donuts, I'm bringing treats, I'm bringing hugs for the clerks, and just words of good cheer. It's part of my job as Secretary of State to cheerlead our elections troops. And I think the public has an important role to play as well in coming together, in using our voices, in demanding of our elected officials that they provide our resources to our elections, that they adhere to the rule of law and the Constitution, but also having some faith and looking for the good in what's happening, look for what could go right and work hard to make it so.
Joyce, a lot of us are rereading Erica Chenoweth and the 3.5%, you know, like if you can mobilize 3.5%, you know, you can change history. How does that thinking sort of play into this moment as we think about the run-up to these pivotal moments in our history?
The instinct behind that, the wisdom behind that, is something that we need to carry forward. You know, I've watched with great interest the rallies that y'all have been having in Maine. You're a well-oiled machine up here. Maine Democrats, so very impressive. And people send me, you know, pictures protesting from the bridge in Wiscasset. I get photos from all over Maine, and I wish, I can't remember now where it came from. It might have been Ellsworth. Somebody sent me a photo from a small protest that was going on in pouring rain with people out holding their signs. I know some people say that the day for rallies is past and they don't matter anymore, that protests won't get us where we need to be. And I strongly disagree with that because I think when we all go out and protest together, we're sort of exercising our democratic muscles and getting ready for what's to come. And it will take that mobilization. It will take just enough of us, as Joe Biden used to like to say, just enough of us to care and to be willing to do the right thing to move the country forward. And the reality is that in a lot of the purple states, and even in some of the red states, margins come election day are pretty small. And even a small swing in the vote can have a dramatic outcome. So that swing might come from young voters, right? I mean, there's this historic desire on the part of the Democratic Party. If just 10% more of people between the ages of 18 and 30 would vote, Democrats would probably win a lot of these close elections and even some of the more difficult ones. We did see that in Georgia, for instance, in 2020, so pivotal in holding the Senate. And I think that the instinct, and I see the 3.5% number. And the only reason I'm going to hedge a little bit is I don't love arbitrary numbers that aren't hinged to a certain election, although I think that there's a great deal of wisdom in that as the animating number. I would just say more people being convinced to vote, more people being convinced to become high information voters so that they're making good decisions, and more Americans, quite literally, I think, taking pie and donuts to the polls. You know, there's nothing more quintessentially American than an election. I love going to vote. I know all the poll workers in my precinct, and it often is a matter of hugs and handshakes and people getting together to carry out one of the greatest traditions in our country's, one of the institutions in American democracy that makes other countries or has in the past made them look to us. And if we can restore confidence in the elections, and most importantly, the number of Americans who are angry and determined not to have their democracy taken away from them, no matter what sort of, and I would agree with the suggestion, peaceful protest, peaceful activity it takes. In the best traditions of Dr. King and of John Lewis, we need to be prepared to make some good trouble in this upcoming election so that there are enough of us there.
So, Shen, I mean, it sounds like confidence in elections is part of the linchpin here. People have to believe. What can we say to each other, to our fellow citizens, to our community members, to communicate to them that they should have confidence, like they've got to believe? Because I know a lot of people think, yeah, this is all going to be messed up. We're looking for what to say to each other to underlie that confidence.
Different people are going to need different things, right? So, for some people, when I talk to an election denier or an election enthusiast who has a lot of questions about how elections work or concerns, they're convinced that perhaps people are somehow cheating in the election. The first thing I say to them is, you should volunteer to be a poll worker. You should go and volunteer on election day. And you can volunteer anywhere in your county. So maybe in your town, they have too many Democrats or too many Republicans, and it does need to be a 50-50 mix. But maybe you could volunteer in this other town where there are fewer people from your political party signed up as volunteers. And usually, when people walk away from those experiences, they walk away completely changed. If they can't volunteer, I say, what about being an observer? And so I actually stood with some of the skeptics of our elections in a special election earlier this spring. And they came away with their minds changed about the strengths of some of our checks and balances. And I was literally narrating what was happening and answering all of their questions. And one of them joked, it was like, you're not as scary as you are on TV. I think we have to demystify the election process. And I think folks don't realize that there are so many checks and balances. They don't realize that it's so accessible that anyone can volunteer or anyone can be an observer. And I think those can be really important steps in building that trust. And then exactly what we're doing today, right? Podcasts, public education events to help share information because elections are complex. The nature of the checks and balances and the attention to detail that goes into every step of election administration from voter registration to the post-election vote verification, it's meticulous, it's detailed, it's not always easy to grasp the first time you hear about it or the first time you're learning about it. I think oversharing is one of the keys, but also asking questions to understand what is it that that person needs to know more about or needs to hear in order to have confidence. And finally, we can't fix all of the things all of the time, right? So no one person can save the entire world in one day, but we can fix things in our sphere of influence. So what is that one thing that you can do? Maybe like me, you're a terrible cook. You're never going to be able to make that pie, but you can buy those donuts. Or, you know, maybe you're not going to be able to volunteer on election day, but you're going to make sure that you vote and that your adult children also vote and that the senior citizens in your life are getting access to the vote as well. So whatever it is in your corner of the world that you can make better, that you can strengthen and have confidence in, I think that's really important too.
So we are kind of running out of time here, and I want to give you each a few minutes to sort of summarize what you want people to take away from this conversation. You go first, Joyce. What's your wrap-up?
Well, you know, I think the wrap-up is what we've been saying throughout this podcast. It's fascinating that you can take, you know, a girl from Maine and a girl from Alabama, and that we'll come up with the same equation for success in the next election and really in keeping our democracy. And the equation is this: do not give up. Do not let them convince you that our elections are unfair or that you shouldn't vote, because no one would work so hard to take your rights away from you unless your rights really mattered. The most important thing that we can do for this upcoming election is to find a way to be part of it. That might be full-on participation. You know, you might become the lead poll worker at your polling place, but your role might be in making sure that one of your neighbors has the childcare that they need so that they can get out to the polls. It could be something as simple as that. The important thing is that you take responsibility for this election. And I mean this seriously, not in an accusatory way, because I think this is something that's new to us. We've been able to take our elections for granted for so long that we're all having to evolve in this new model where we actually have to participate in our elections and in the process that makes our elections free and fair if they're going to stay that way. So find your slice of the pie, whether it's literally baking the pie and taking it down, working the election, or helping people vote, and then commit to doing that. Make sure you're committed and that you're present.
Jenna, final words from you.
I've been thinking a lot about history lately, and I've been reading a lot of history for solace during these times, because it feels like we're in a very dark time and that we're sliding back in some areas. And as former executive director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine, I did a lot of teaching of one of the world's hardest pieces of history, and that was the Holocaust and the genocide that happened there. I think one of the lessons is that good people never gave up, just like Joyce said. In the very darkest, worst, most horrible times in our history, good people have kept moving forward with a vision of what should be and the way the world must be for the future and for the next generation. It doesn't have to be huge acts of heroism. If you don't want to stand out on a bridge with a sign, you don't have to. But there are things that each one of us can do to make a difference and move our nation forward through to a better time, and to ensure that our elections in 2026 and 2028 are free, safe, and secure, just as they always have been, because failure is not an option.
That's our show for today. Thank you to our guests this afternoon, Shenna Bellows, the Maine Secretary of State, and Joyce Vance, Distinguished Professor of the Practice of Law at the University of Alabama School of Law. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in this series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks so much for listening.